Good afternoon and welcome to today's meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, the place where you're in the know. You can find us on the internet at commonwealthclub.org. Today's program is part of the Commonwealth Club's Good Lit series, underwritten by the Bernard Osher Foundation. I'm Dr. Brenda Wade, psychologist, author, and host of Black Renaissance on the CW Network here in San Francisco. And I'm your moderator for today's program. It's an honor to be with you. It's now my pleasure to introduce tonight's distinguished guest, Gary Pomerantz, journalist, visiting lecturer in the Department of Communication at Stanford University, and author of the new book, The Devil's Tickets, A Night of Bridge, A Fatal Hand, and A New American Age. Well, very interesting topic. I had a chance to peruse Mr. Pomerantz's book, and I was most intrigued by The Night of Bridge, Fatal Hand, and A New American Age, and how those three topics were blended so skillfully together. And having been a non-bridge player, I'm very intrigued. Who knew bridge could be so exciting? So it's very interesting for me, Mr. Pomerantz, to hear your comments, and I know our audience is eagerly awaiting your talk about this wonderful new book. So if you please grace us with your remarks.
Thank you, Dr. Wade. There's an old saying, and it goes something like this. There are two things in life that you never do with your spouse. Number one, you never hang wallpaper together. And number two, you never play together as bridge partners. Bad things can happen, and we are going to explore this today. Now, some of you might have noticed the title for my speech. The competitive tensions in marriage at the bridge table and other games. And for those of you who looked at the Commonwealth Club website, you might have also noticed this kicker. And I quote here, Pomerantz tells us the history of one card game that will make you see grandma in a whole new light. It's a great kicker. I wish I could claim it as my own. My new book, The Devil's Tickets, explores two of the greatest mysteries known to mankind, a deck of cards and the institution of marriage. A bridge partnership is a bit like marriage. It's based on communication, trust, subtle reads, and a whole lot of forbearance. And often expectations will rise, and inevitably the disappointments come. And in bridge, as in marriage, the issue will become, how's my partner treating me? And as in marriage, the primary conflict in the bridge partnership often is, who's in charge? Who's in charge? Now, I've heard the marital bridge wars compared to those marital wars in mixed doubles tennis. There's plenty of marital strife in that tennis partnership, too. But there are a couple of significant differences. In tennis, the husband is usually bigger and stronger and acknowledged as a better player, and that suits the male ego. Not so in bridge, because in social bridge, the wife is often the better player, which does not suit the male ego. On the tennis court, when you get frustrated with your partner, you can just hit the ball harder. But what do you do at the bridge table when you're frustrated with your partner? The late Frank Bessing, family therapist who was a self-professed bridge addict for 40 years, told me that when a bridge partner, when your bridge partner doesn't follow your agreement, you feel attacked on a primitive level. Bessing said, I think it pushes the button where you get this big shot of adrenaline. You're ready for fight or flight. Now, you really can't get up and run from the table, he said, although I've seen others do it more than once. But in one way or another, you're physiologically responding as if there's an enemy sitting across the table from you. And as Bessing well knew in many instances, the enemy sitting across the table from you is your spouse. And so it can get dicey. Now, as a matter of background, The Devil's Tickets is my fourth book. My first book was a sprawling saga spanning 150 years about Atlanta and its historic rise from the ashes. It traced two of the defining political families of the South. My second book was entitled 9 Minutes and 20 Seconds, and it was about a plane that fell through the air, ultimately crashed. A twin-engine turboprop known as a Brasilia flying as a Delta commuter. It was really a story about the extraordinary nature of ordinary people. 29 people were aboard that plane. 19 survived. All of them had to run through fire to get out of the fuselage. And 10 perished, including the captain. The last words captured on the cockpit recorder came from the young co-pilot who called out to his wife, much as a seaman would leave that message in a bottle. He said, "Amy, I love you." And the cockpit recorder went silent. He did survive the crash and amazingly fought back from the brink of death and is now flying again for Delta. More than likely, you've not heard of 9 Minutes and 20 Seconds, and for good reason. The book came out the week of 9/11. And, of course, in the fall of 2001, no book got any traction. But I like to say that my book, 9 Minutes and 20 Seconds, is the only book in history with the same title as Shelf Life. My third book was about an unforgettable night in American sports history, the night that the basketball star, Wilt Chamberlain, scored 100 points in a single game against the New York Knicks in the famous chocolate town of Hershey, Pennsylvania. So if you think about my last three books, you got a book on Atlanta and its racial conscience, a book about a plane falling, and a book about a basketball game. So naturally, this time, I wrote about the Roaring Twenties and bridge. Really, what ties all my work together is history. I love history. I revere it. It speaks to me, and I hope it speaks to you. It's critical that we learn from the past. The title for this book, incidentally, The Devil's Tickets, comes from history. It's what the New England Puritans used to call playing cards, the devil's tickets. They saw playing cards as satanic seeds of vice and corruption and laziness. The idea for this book came to me from Warren Buffett, the billionaire investor, who's a man I've never met. Buffett, as some of you may know, is an inveterate bridge player. He loves bridge. He plays it all the time. He plays online, he plays in tournaments, and he plays with his great friend Bill Gates. Bridge has always captured the hearts and minds of intelligent, competitive, compulsive people. And so about 4 years ago, my literary agent, David Black, went to see Buffett in Omaha. And Buffett started telling him all about a time when bridge was all the rage. This would have been the late 1920s and early 30s. And back then, bridge wasn't old and fuddy-duddy. I mean, it was young and sexy, and everyone was playing. Out in Hollywood, the movie moguls were playing, Samuel Goldwyn and Louis Mayer. And in New York, those catty writers at the Algonquin Round Table, they were all playing bridge. Even the New York Yankees, Babe Ruth, Lou Gehrig, they were playing bridge with sports writers in hotels and on trains. And so David Black calls me after he talked with Warren Buffett, and he says, "Got a book idea for you." I said, "Okay, great, I'm all ears." And I hear him say something about bridge. And I'm thinking, Golden Gate Bridge? Brooklyn Bridge? David McCullough's already handled the Brooklyn Bridge, did a pretty good job on it. He says, no, the card game of bridge. And so he starts to tell me what Warren said. And you know, the thing about David Black is, while he's a fantastic literary agent, most of his book ideas are terrible. I mean, they're terrible. You wouldn't want to read it. You wouldn't want to write it. But there was something about this idea. And he said, and Warren even said, there was this bridge table murder and trial. I'm thinking, well, trials are good. So I said, David, let me look into this. And I started to research it. And what happened was, it was the best case scenario for narrative nonfiction. The story deepened, it thickened, it became much like quicksand. And so as I was consuming it, it was consuming me. The Roaring Twenties is a forgotten time. It was a breakout time. It was excess in every direction, material, sexual. Think about Al Capone, you know, Prohibition, bathtub gin. There was this outrageous behavior and these outlandish fads like marathon floating contests and swimming pools and flagpole sitting. And somehow bridge, contract bridge, takes off. And you know, you think about bridge, a partnership game for four, two against two, descended from whist, which was the preferred game of Napoleon and Talleyrand and Thomas Jefferson. My question is, in a breakout time like that, how does bridge catch fire? And the answer I learned in my research was it required two things. First, a galvanizing figure. Had to have a galvanizing figure. And second, a flashpoint moment that dramatized the game. And that was the now infamous Bennett bridge table killing and trial in Kansas City. The galvanizing figure was Ely Culbertson. Now, today everybody's heard of Charles Gorin as the man of bridge. Well, before there was Gorin, there was Culbertson, and he was the P.T. Barnum of this bridge craze. Culbertson was spotlessly manicured in his tuxedo, an elegant man, spoke with a Russian accent. He was born in Russia, and he married a beautiful American woman who was a bridge champion in her own right, Josephine Culbertson. And remember now, this is taken off in the 20s. Think about the 20s. That's the decade in which women get the right to vote, and they begin to find voice in new and exciting ways across American culture. In selling bridge, Culbertson was selling equality. He was selling equality. He was telling American housewives, who loved him, that if you want true equality, the bridge table is your place. It's the one place where, by dint of your skill and your intellect, you can be your husband's equal and more. He would say, if you want equality, and remember, this is now start to get into the Depression years, when every cent count, he counts, he says, you only need to spend 25 cents on a deck of cards and, oh yeah, $1.50 on one of my bridge instruction books. Culbertson did this as a master salesman, and he did this knowing that most husbands didn't want to follow their wives' leads at the bridge table or anywhere else for that matter. Some might say it's still a little bit that way today. He knew there would be these husband-wife implosions, and he wanted those. He craved those because they helped him sell the game. They dramatized a game that otherwise lived entirely in the mind. He was selling the Battle of the Sexes. A lot of people think the Battle of the Sexes started on a tennis court in 1973 with Billie Jean King and Bobby Riggs. No. It was alive and well at least a half century before that at the bridge table. And oftentimes it pitted husband against wife who ostensibly were playing as partners. He went even farther. Culbertson was selling bridge as sex. He founded his Bridge World magazine in October of 1929. And here I quote Culbertson writing, "This new Culbertson system has splashes of romance in it. It's thrilling. Take forcing bids, for instance. Partner is held by the throat and willy-nilly must obey your sovereign commands. At last, you can satisfy your inferiority complex through the thrill of an absolute, inexorable command over another being, thus reviving the feeling of godly omnipotence lost in the dim childhood." Exhale. On lecture tour, housewives just adored him. He always made a point to refer to his wife Josephine as my favorite partner. My favorite partner. And we know now from the distance of 80 years that their marriage was fractured, a lot of tension in the marriage. And when he said, Josephine is my favorite partner, housewives swooned. Many of them thinking, if only my husband referred to me as his favorite partner. It was a marketing ploy. But let's examine Ely Culbertson for a moment. Okay, Ely Culbertson, about 7 years before he met Josephine, take it back now to 1915. He's 23 years old and living his richly entitled life on czarist rubles, holed up in a Geneva hotel. And this at a time when Europe is being torn by war. And he decided that if he couldn't find the ideal woman, he would, with a system, create her. He would create her, and he had in mind Galatea, the figure in Greek mythology, carved from ivory and so beautiful that her sculptor, Pygmalion fell in love with her. And with Pygmalion's love and Aphrodite's spark, Galatea sprang to life. Culbertson, here was his idea. He determined to find a young woman who was both beautiful and refined, whose personality was not yet fully formed. He would place her in an environment filled with books and tutors and big ideas, and they would live in this cultured setting, London or Paris perhaps, and there he would shape a superior woman, his perfect partner, his Galatea. And there was even this moment of youthful romanticism and naivete when Culbertson goes to Turin, Italy, where he believed the world's most beautiful women lived. And he placed an ad there in the newspaper announcing himself, with no small deceit, as an American painter in search of an exceptional model. He said in his ad that he sought a woman between the ages of 18 and 21 years, between 5'4" and 5'6", a waist measuring between 24 and 26 inches. It gets better. With large eyes, preferably black with blonde hair, or blue eyes with black hair would be okay, and so on. Hundreds of women answered his ad. And there the young Ely Culbertson was, in his derby and in his suit, wearing a white carnation on the lapel, which was his identifying marker, moving through this piazza, sniffing the air like a Russian prince, going from corner to corner, interviewing the women who had applied to his ad. Needless to say, he did not find his Galatea. But he's a man of his time, and the question I put to you is, what does a man like this really think of women? Now, of course, we've come far in the women's movement, and we take so much of this progress for granted. But make no mistake, in the 1920s, which is the landscape for my story, male chauvinism was thick. It was everywhere. It was like an atmospheric pressure. There were times during my research when I was ashamed for my gender. I was embarrassed to be a guy. There's one moment in The Devil's Tickets when this defense attorney says in trial, and she obeyed her husband, as a wife should. And another moment when Henry Ford, the automobile titan, in a 1923 interview, said that wives needed to be more tolerant of their husbands' sexual infidelities. He said they need to treat it like the measles. They need to be more understanding and stand by their man. Dear, dear Henry. Of course, at this time, too, you had these iconic women who were breaking all kinds of new ground up in the sky. There's the aviator, Amelia Earhart. She becomes Lady Lindy. And back at that Algonquin round table, the poet Dorothy Parker trading barbs with all those male writers. And her barbs were every bit as manly as theirs. The most famous about the girls at the Yale prom. Dorothy Parker said, "If all the girls in attendance were laid end to end, I wouldn't be at all surprised." And there's the actress Marlene Dietrich. There she was in 1930 in the film Morocco, dressed as a man in top hat and tails. She's a cabaret singer. She's smoking her cigarettes. Sultry voice. And she goes to a table and plants a long, steamy kiss on the lips of another woman. 1930. And so for such boldness, male critics would disparage Dietrich and Dorothy Parker as unseemly or scandalous. Okay, so now that flashpoint moment. September 29th, 1929, 80 years ago, 3 weeks before the market crashed, the husbands, Jack and Charles, and the wives, Mamie and Myrtle, it was the Bennets against the Hoffmans, okay, playing as couples, husband and wife against husband and wife. They're young, in their 30s, socially, financially, on the rise, living in the country club district in Kansas City. Very prestigious address. And as the midnight hour comes, the cards turn against the Bennets, and then the Bennets turn against each other. And in what becomes, unbelievably, the final bridge hand of Jack Bennett's life,
he fails a four-spade contract. And his wife, Myrtle, who took her bridge seriously, laid into him. She said, "You're a bum bridge player, Jack." Those were fighting words in 1929. And Jack says, "Well, maybe I'm not the only one." And it intensifies until finally Jack stands. And he's looming over the table. He's looming over the Hoffmans, looming over Myrtle, his wife. Myrtle now knows Jack as an alpha male. That's fairly obvious. But she also knows him as a philanderer because 4 years earlier, she'd found a love letter from another woman to Jack, and there'd been a tension in the marriage ever since. And what Culbertson knew was that when husband and wife played bridge together as partners, it wasn't just the cards on the table. It was the marriage itself that was on the table. And so now Jack, looming over the table, reaches across and grabs Myrtle by the wrist and slaps her in the face several times hard. The Hoffmans, naturally, are aghast. Myrtle breaks down sobbing, goes over to the Davenport, and the Hoffmans sit on either side of her, consoling and comforting her. Myrtle says, "Only a cur would strike a woman in front of her guests." Jack says, "I'm leaving." She says, "Then go." And he begins to pack his bag. Well, bad enough that the cad husband, Jack Bennett, struck his wife. Now he's about to compound his mistake by ordering her to go get my gun, which he carried with him on the road, a .32 Colt automatic pistol. He was a traveling salesman. But there's a really bad sequence. Well, guess what happened? Here comes Myrtle, and there goes Jack. 4 bullets later, Jack Bennett's dead on his living room floor, Myrtle cradling him, calling to him. And, remember, this was 1929, the Prohibition era. They had been drinking. They had been gambling a little bit just to spice it up, a tenth of a cent a point. The newspapers seized upon this story like a mastiff with a soup bone. This was the beginning of the modern media age. You have newsreels and you have talkie films. The tabloid era started in New York in 1920 with the New York Daily News. And most famously, you have radio, now in 40% of American homes. Well, the trial, of course, was one of those trials of the century. Every trial was, Sacco and Vanzetti, Leopold and Loeb and Scopes. I don't know how it could have been trial of the century when the century still had 70 years to go, but there you have it. And as her defense attorney, Myrtle Bennett hires a Democratic presidential candidate, the most famous man in Kansas City. His name, Jim Reed, or Senator, U.S. Senator James A. Reed, 3 terms from Missouri. He'd just come back in 1929 and now was a practicing lawyer. He smoked cigars with H.L. Mencken, and he counted William Randolph Hearst and Clarence Darrow as close friends. He was a legendary orator. His oratory soared in the Senate all the way to the newspaper headlines the next day. His oratory hearkened to some of the greats of the Senate past, Calhoun and Clay and Webster. Reed, though a Democrat, had sided with the Republican irreconcilables who brought down Woodrow Wilson's League of Nations. Wilson hated Reed for it, called him a marplot, a subversive. Harry Truman also hated Jim Reed for it, for his party disloyalty and what he'd done to Woodrow Wilson. And remember now, at the time of the trial, which will take place in 1931, Harry Truman, who is, like Reed, a Pendergast machine politician, is but a county courthouse administrator in Independence, Missouri. And if the people of Jackson County in 1931, at the time of the trial, thought that there was a future president in their midst, no one was thinking it was Harry Truman. It had to be Jim Reed. Well, I can tell you that even as I researched this trial 80 years later, I all but felt the men of the jury bowing to the great Senator Reed. And I say men of the jury because there were no women jurors in the Bennett trial. 31 states, Missouri included, did not allow women to be jurors at that time. So truly, Myrtle Bennett was not tried by a jury of her peers. It was a high society trial. I mean, the elite women of Kansas City showed up in their furs to see the great Senator Reed in what was believed to be his last criminal trial. And, of course, the bridge players among them showed up because they wanted to know how far they could push their own husbands at the bridge table. And as Senator Reid is shedding his crocodile tears in the opening statement, and he's waxing on about the sanctity of womanhood, he was carrying on an extramarital affair with his next-door neighbor who was married to another man. Jim Reid had a case of Henry Ford's measles. And in fact, the woman who lived next door was Nell Donnelly, who was a millionaire, businesswoman, the Nellie Don Dress Company, a pioneer among businesswomen. At the time of the trial, she was 2 months pregnant, carrying Jim Reed's son. And this is why I'll never write fiction, because you can't make this stuff up. And by the way, in New York, someone's watching this trial, our friend, the P.T. Barnum, E. Lee Culbertson, and he's exploiting this Bennett tragedy, writing about it in his magazine, talking about it on lecture tour everywhere. And he's telling housewives across America in these packed auditoriums, if only the Bennetts had been playing the Culbertson bidding system, Jack would still be alive. He really was the greatest promoter of playing cards since Edmund Hoyle. And in fact, later in that same year, December of 1931, Culbertson pulled off his advertising masterstroke. It was called, of course, the Bridge Battle of the Century. He and his wife, Josephine, played for, you know, all the marbles in the bridge world against two elite men players named Sidney Lenz and Oswald Jacoby. And it was pitted as a battle of bidding systems, the Culbertson system against the official system. But Culbertson, never one to miss his selling opportunity, pitched it as a battle of a young married couple against an old, evil empire. Never mind that one of his opponents, Oswald Jacoby, was 4 years younger than Joe and about 12 years younger than Ely. But this wasn't about truth. It was about salesmanship. And so here comes the bridge battle of the century. 5 weeks it lasted, 4 nights a week, 20 sessions in all. And it's front page news in American newspapers. And I don't think I'm stealing too much of the story to tell you that the Culbertsons did win the bridge battle of the century. High society crowd there, Grand Duchess Marie of Russia, and there were Astors and Marshall Fields. First half played in the Culbertsons' 12-room apartment suite at the Chatham Hotel. The second half at the famed, newly opened Waldorf Astoria. Famous journalists there, Ring Lardner, Grantland Rice, Damon Runyon, Westbrook Pegler. And when the Culbertsons win that bridge battle of the century, they become Depression-era millionaires. They're endorsing Wrigley's gum and Chesterfield cigarettes. In 1932, RKO Radio Pictures paid Ely Culbertson $270,000, a lot of money then, to make 12 bridge film shorts. He made 6 of them. And they were so fed up with him. He was so difficult and obstreperous. They said, just go away and we'll pay you everything. And that's sort of what happened. But at a time when the Tin Pan Alley song, Brother, Can You Spare a Dime, is a hit, Ely Culbertson is spending $7 a day on cigarettes. And in 1934, he and Josephine buy this mansion in Ridgefield, Connecticut, with 45 rooms, paved roads, lakes, greenhouses bursting with tangerines. It was quite a mansion. But, of course, later, Joe would leave Ely, and Ely would leave Bridge, and he would play a new game. He would try to save the world. He secreted himself behind a sliding bookcase in his New York apartment, and there, alone in his silk bathrobe, with his thoughts and smoking his Melocrino Egyptian-style cigarettes, he devised a peace plan to keep the world from nuclear destruction. He believed he was the only man alive smart enough to save the world from itself. His unraveling was as spectacular as his ascension. Now, to me, the joy of narrative nonfiction is in the research. It surely isn't in the writing. Too hard, the writing. The research is the fun part. And for the Devil's Tickets, I spent considerable time in Kansas City. I went to the Bennett apartment, still there, still at Tony Place. And one of the neighbors escorted me in, and I was holding in my hand a piece of paper that was a photocopy of an exhibit used in the Bennett murder trial. It was a diagram of the apartment, and it had arrows pointing the direction that Myrtle walked and that Jack walked and a little X where Jack fell and died. And so the neighbor said, well, where did this guy die? And we were standing in the living room. So I looked to his right. I looked to his left. I looked at him. I looked down. I said, I think you're standing on Jack right now, and took a couple steps back. I even found the .32 Colt automatic pistol. I say even because it was no small trick. It hasn't been made by Colt for a half century. But I needed to know the killing sensation. I needed to feel what Myrtle felt. That's the trick of narrative nonfiction. You're trying to put the reader on the page so that the reader experiences on the page what your characters experienced in real time. So it wasn't one of my prouder moments tromping through gun shops in the Bay Area saying, excuse me, do you have a .32 Colt automatic pistol? No, thank you, and I was on to the next. But finally I found one, and I went to a shooting range, indoor shooting range in Marin County. And I fired a couple times, so I could feel the sensation. Very small gun, lightweight, 23 ounces, fit perfectly in my hand, must have fit well in Myrtle's hand. And so I handed the gun back to the owner. And I said, I need to stand 3 paces behind you, and I want you to take 2 shots. And I removed my ear cover, which is like earmuffs to protect your ears from the sound of the firing. And he said, don't remove those from your ear. And I said, why? And he said, they're going to kill your ears. And I said, you don't understand. I need to hear this. So he said, okay. And so he fired twice in rapid succession. Bam, bam. And my head snapped back. And for about the next 4 or 5 minutes, all I could hear deep in my inner ear was this shrill siren. And somewhere during that 4 or 5 minutes, it struck me. No wonder why Charles Hoffman, who was standing 3 paces behind Myrtle when she took the first 2 shots, testified that he never heard the 3rd and 4th shots. He must have heard that same shrill siren. And so my point is that even at this great distance from the actual event, there's still research to be done that can bring to life new things. I am excited for you to explore the book further. We definitely can learn from the past, and lest you think that the past truly is past, I will tell you that when I was on book tour, I went to a elite New York bridge club, and I spoke there. And there I was told that during the past 18 months, there have been 2 occasions where there are 2 marital slappings at the bridge table. But times have changed a little bit because at least there, in both cases, the wife had slapped the husband. And when I spoke in Atlanta, there were about 50 members of the Atlanta Duplicate Bridge Association. I just threw out the question. I said, how many of you have seen or felt marital tension at the bridge table? 47 hands went up, all but 3. And in closing, I tell you that I did learn to play bridge during my research. It may be an overstatement to say I play bridge. I feel more that bridge plays me. My wife, Carrie, does not play bridge, and that's probably a good thing. Maybe even the surest way to marital bliss. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. Gary Pomerantz, journalist, visiting lecturer in the Department of Communication at Stanford University, author of the new book, The Devil's Tickets, A Night of Bridge, A Fatal Hand, and A New American Age. It's now time for our audience questions. And we have a number of questions here, so let's begin. And I've organized them. We have questions about bridge, questions about journalism, questions about relationships. And let's start with a bridge question. I was a bridge major, my God, in college circa 1950. Whatever happened to Gorin, and do you remember the gold book?
Which college has a bridge major?
Exactly.
I'm interested. Okay. Well, first, Gorin. Charles Gorin replaced Culbertson. When Culbertson left the bridge community in 1938, Gorin would emerge, and he wrote his seminal Point Count book in 1949. Bridge continued to surge, never quite at that fever pitch. You can't retain a fever pitch for a sustained period in anything. But Bridge remained enormously popular through the 1940s and into the 50s. And in fact, in 1958, Gorin hosted a television program about Bridge, and it lasted for 5 years into the 60s. He died at the age, I believe, of 91. The other question was about the Gold Book. Yes, Ely Culbertson, he was a planner, and he had designed his whole attack and how he would take over the Bridge community from the existing Bridge authorities. And he decided first he would write a blue book, the Contract Bridge Blue Book, which came out in 1931, and then he came out with a summary of it, a little pamphlet that could fit in a woman's purse or in a man's sports coat. Then he did his Red Book and a summary, and the Gold Book and a summary, and all of them were big sellers. The Blue Book was his biggest selling book, and in fact, in 1932, Ely Culbertson was America's number one selling author. He outsold the novelist Pearl Buck.
Hmm. Wow. What reaction have you gotten from Bridge players to your book? And what reaction from modern couples?
Well, let me take on the Bridge part of that equation first. The reaction from the Bridge community has been fantastic. I think they're thrilled to have someone writing about their sub-universe. And it is quite an interesting sub-universe. And I must say, though, that because I am not counting my master points, I think there are the more elite players who view me as an outsider. And I felt this way, honestly, much this way when I was working on my first book about Atlanta. You know, when I would be sitting in an interview and interviewing someone, you know, who'd been a native of the South or Atlanta and, say, older than, I don't know, 60, they'd say, "Mr. Pomerantz, where are you from?" And if I ever, you know, said that I'd gone to Berkeley as an undergrad, who knows what they would have done. But there's been overwhelmingly, there's been a respect. Among couples, it's been interesting. Those who don't play Bridge would say, "Well, of course, I'd never play Bridge with my husband either." Or you know, spats that come out at other times. And you get into that tension line in marriage, you know, the competitiveness. Sometimes that competitiveness is pointed at each other.
And I have to add a footnote here as a marital psychologist that those tensions also have a lot to do with what we call intergenerational patterns, that people who grow up with patterns of conflict in their parents' marriage or their grandparents' marriage tend to bring that into every aspect of the marriage, including the Bridge table. So I'm not surprised you would find that. So, Bridge question. Do you think defense or offense is more important in Bridge?
You know, I always feel like I should hold up a sign that said, "I am not a Bridge expert." So in a generic sense, I like offense in all things.
Okay, and here's a journalism question for you. Take a break from Bridge for just a moment. I hope I won't disappoint anyone. What do you think about newspapers' future now that technology has changed the importance of today's newspapers? It seems that the only stories that we get to read are actually just headlines.
I have strong feelings about this, of course. I am a visiting lecturer and have been for the past 3 years at Stanford teaching the great profession of journalism, teaching writing and reporting. This much I know. We're in the middle of a revolution, a technological revolution. But from the beginning of human history, there's always been a need for stories and for storytelling. I mean, it started on cave walls with the art. And then we advance and we get to the Gutenberg Revolution, and that serves us for nearly 600 years. And now a new revolution. News matters, and stories matter. We care deeply about everyone around us and the world. And so what I know is those stories will continue to be told. I just don't know who's going to pay the storytellers and how much they'll be paid. And it's a scary, an especially scary time for journalists who are in their, you know, 40s, 50s, and 60s. They've got college tuitions to pay and mortgages. But it's a thrilling time for the young, aspiring journalists just coming out of college, because this is a computer world they're well familiar with. And I do think an entrepreneurial spirit is needed now more for the reporters to be thinking not only about news and the context and the preparation, but also just about a business sense of how they're going to get by.
I think you just answered part of this question, which is, what do you tell your students about what's becoming of print journalism?
Well, I talk about journalism. You know, I don't split it between electronic and print. We've got convergence now, and everything is coming together. What I tell them is that I've loved every second of my career as a writer. You know, I had started out as a sports writer at the Washington Post, and then I moved into writing about race and politics. I spent years at the Atlanta Constitution. I was on the editorial board for a time there, and then went into teaching at Emory University, and now at Stanford. There's nothing better than the thrill of a great story. I mean, we all know there's nothing better than to tell someone something they didn't know, and I don't think that's going to change. It's been a wonderful professional life, but they need to go in with clear eyes. They can't live in this, lollipop world of pixie dust, and they've got to go in knowing that the models are changing, and so they need to adapt. They need to be able to handle, nowadays, if you're going out to cover a story, you bring not only a notepad and pen, you bring a still camera and a video camera. And so you've got to be able to handle all of that.
Let's talk about Mr. and Mrs. Bennett, shall we? Were the Bennetts playing contract or duplicate bridge on the day of the shooting?
Well, Jack was playing bad bridge. Now, this was just a social game of bridge. This was not a duplicate game. This is just the two couples. And, it was interesting. Part of Culbertson's selling genius was to create or recreate the so-called fatal hand, the last hand in Jack Bennett's life. And it has been in bridge anthologies for 80 years. People accept it as fact. But I would ask you to think about this for a moment. Social bridge players never remember the distribution of cards. They'll remember the bidding sequence. But they're especially not likely to remember it when one of the four is lying dead on the floor. Now, nowhere in the coverage of that murder, that killing, did I see the hand. But I can tell you that in statements made to police in Kansas City in the Country Club District that night, Mamie Hoffman did talk about the bidding sequence, and she put it in order. So that, that's easy to remember, One spade, two diamonds, four spades, and so forth. That's not hard to remember. But knowing the cards in everybody's hands, no. So they were not playing duplicate. It was just social bridge.
I want to remind you that you are listening to the Commonwealth Club of California radio program, and our speaker today is journalist and visiting lecturer at Stanford University, whose new book, The Devil's Tickets, deals with the competitive tensions that games like bridge can create in marital relationships, Mr. Gary Pomerantz. And Gary, what role did bridge play in the defense of Mrs. Bennett? Also, why did the insurance company award $30,000 to Mrs. Bennett?
Well, Jim Reed was a very savvy attorney. And, I've thought, what would have happened if this trial had been held today? Obviously, law has changed quite a bit, and there's no way to be sure what would have happened today. But this much I know, that, just as Fred Astaire would be a great dancer if he was out there today, great attorneys, I mean, that skill set transfers over time. It's portable, and I think a great attorney then is apt to be a great attorney today. He scrupulously kept bridge out of this trial, and he focused it entirely on Jack Bennett's character. But he set it up in such a way that, he could approach a self-defense, an accidental defense, a crime of passion, all of those. And in mid-trial, he still had his options open, and the prosecutor saying, "Judge," he said that this was accidental. Now he's talking about self-defense. And the judge, by the way, was also a Pendergast machine politician. And Jim Reed had, during the time when they were picking juries, or the jurors, had Pendergast aldermen and their underlings canvassing the community to find out every last detail about the life and leanings of prospective jurors. So scrupulously, he kept Bridge out of it. And the second part of the question again?
Why did Mrs. Bennett get paid $30,000 from an insurance company?
Well, I've been trying not to tell you what happened in the trial. I have to think about this one for a while.
You'll have to read the book to find out.
Yeah, good answer. Good answer. I'm going to acknowledge you now in my next book for that. Thank you.
Moving on. Let's talk about young people. Why don't young people play bridge? What's happened?
Well, young people are playing bridge over in Europe for some reason and not as much here. Bridge takes time to learn. Poker, you can learn the basics of Texas Hold'em in about 30 minutes. But bridge, as the professionals would say, cannot be perfected. It's a difficult game, and it takes time, and it takes a willingness to absorb yourself in the game, in its rhythms, and to find partners who won't shoot you. But today's younger generation, and I have three members of that generation at home, you know, they live in this hectic, speeded-up computer world, and do they have the attention span in this generation to take on that game? I think most of the experts would say probably not. But Warren Buffett and Bill Gates have sponsored a program that Sharon Osbourg, a women's world champion bridge player here in the Bay Area, is spearheading to teach bridge to young people today in junior high school and high schools. And the ACBL would tell you that the membership numbers have increased 7% this year or over the last year. The average age, though, of an ACBL, American Contract Bridge League player, is 69. And there are 160,000, roughly, members of the ACBL today.
I think when they perfect the game that you can text to your partner, that's when young people will catch on, at least. That's what I gather from my own next generation, when they can text under the dinner table with the bid.
That might be cheating.
Undoubtedly. Undoubtedly. So what are you going to write about in your next book? Any more crime stories?
I wish I could tell you what I was going to write about in my next book. To me, the hardest part about writing books is not the execution of the idea. It's coming up with the idea itself. That's just been so hard for me. Some writers are great in that they, you know, as they're doing the research, they come across another subject that catches fire with them, and they run with it as soon as they're done, and they move seamlessly from one book to another. I am not that kind of writer. To me, it's always full immersion. That probably borders on obsession. You know, it's a living, right? And so I'm so consumed with what I'm working on that it's very difficult for me to shift and go directly into something else. I have a bunch of ideas, but most of them are not very good. So if you want to pass cards around for people with book ideas so they can quick.
So how has this book influenced your own marriage and your own friendships, given that it's about relationships and marital tensions?
Well, Carrie and I are about to celebrate our 25th anniversary.
Congratulations.
So thank you, yes. And to date, in 25 years, we've not played any bridge.
Which may be the secret to your marital success.
It may be the secret to that, yeah.
On the other hand, I imagine as a psychologist, and I always recommend to couples that I work with, that they have a date night. And date night is given over to romance and fun. So would you say bridge is something I could recommend as a good date night, or are we risking murder and mayhem?
You're rolling the dice on that one.
Okay. So I'll have to be very, very circumspect.
The truth of the matter is most couples do famously well at the bridge table. Josephine Culbertson used to say there are three kinds of bridge couples. There are those who fight everywhere, right? And they're going to fight at the bridge table. There are those that fight only at the bridge table and nowhere else. And then there are those couples that are more like Ely and Joe who kept it together at the bridge table but nowhere else. They fought everywhere else.
Interesting. So there goes my theory that personality is consistent across all situations, which is generally believed to be true, but not when it comes to bridge, apparently. So if someone came to you today and they wanted to learn the game of bridge, what would you suggest? And is there a book you would suggest that they learn from?
I don't know that I would suggest one particular book. There are many bridge beginner books out there. But I would say rush to the game. It is a fantastic game. I've loved it in playing. But be patient. Be patient with the game. Be patient with yourself. And especially be patient with your partner. It's all consuming. And there are all kinds of studies that show that people in their 80s, 90s are playing bridge, and it keeps them mentally sharp. And it makes sense because you can't just fade in and out of a bridge hand. You've got to be locked and loaded? Just locked.
Forget loaded. So bridge could potentially increase mental and neurological function. Is it possible it could increase marital happiness?
I would like to hold up the mirror there and put that question to you, because I think you might be better suited to answer that one, certainly.
Well, let me go straight to the research about what does improve marriages. We know that the strongest marriages are those that work on what John Gottman of the University of Washington calls the four A's: appreciation, acceptance, acknowledgement, and admiration. Surprise, surprise. So if we bring that to any aspect of our lives, I imagine including bridge, boy, that was a great bid you just put there. Wow, you're playing a great hand. I would think any of those things brought to bridge would improve a marriage as well.
I think that's very true at bridge. Think of it as a team sport. This sense of team is important. And, bad things will happen at the bridge table. You're not, rest assured, they will happen. Let me put it this way. Oftentimes it's said that, you'll see a person's true personality come out when times are tough. And that's true at the bridge table, too. So the four A's, yeah, I think that's...
Yeah, and I also think under stress, people go to their basic coping style, their basic communication. So if the game gets stressful and the stakes are high or anything like that, we're more likely to see something like what happened with the Bennetts. But I would have to guess, and you have to tell me if this is true, that Eli had two things going that night that made it difficult for him to function at a higher level. Number one, he'd been drinking a lot. How often do we see alcohol or some kind of addiction play a role in marital discord? And did he have a family history of violence?
Yeah, that's a great question. And that's where Jim Reed put his focus, on Jack Bennett, his character, and these moments in the past. He brought in two witnesses who testified, actually three, if you include Myrtle's mother, who testified that they had seen Jack strike Myrtle before, and three other times at least it was there. And as hard as the prosecutor fought to keep that out, Reed, in establishing these multiple defenses and having a judge who was very friendly with Reed, was able to get this through, and it was very damaging to the prosecutor's case. So this was, in today's terms, Myrtle Bennett would be called a physically abused housewife.
Mm-hmm. And what we know now is that the legal system has begun to understand that a woman who feels she has no options will sometimes take the law into her own hands. And Myrtle Bennett may have been the first on record to do it. Right. Do you believe that bridge and other card games play a role in, I'm sorry I couldn't decipher one of the words in this question, but I believe it says moving nights that are lacking in hospitality forward? Am I anywhere close? I think what this person wants to know is bridge going to make a boring night more exciting? Can I restate that?
It sure did for the Bennetts.
For
there are three people who were around to testify that it was an exciting night indeed. Bridge is a great game. And for those who get into it, they really, really get into it because it's competitive, it's social. I mean, part of the reason it took off in the 30s is it was the perfect antidote for the hostess who, when another couple dropped in unannounced. It was the perfect way for two couples to sit down and spend the night together. It didn't cost much. And even more important, back in the trying times of the Depression, couples didn't have to talk. They didn't have to talk about their many problems. And in 19, during the 30s, couples had many problems.
That makes a lot of sense, actually, because there's something to be said for taking a break from problems. It's relaxing if you're in the midst of a stressful time. I like this question. Do you think that men and women play bridge differently? In other words, do you think that men are bigger risk takers in their bidding and collecting tricks than women?
It's a wonderful question, and I spent considerable time with elite bridge players, and I was surprised what I found a little bit in that answer. I think the elite bridge players would tell you that there is a difference, that men bring that bravado, that swagger to maybe from the poker table to the bridge table. There are several top women's players who've told me that they would much prefer to play with a man than a woman, just because when it gets to that tough moment, they just feel that men are tougher. That's their take on it. There are many elite women bridge players who can hold their own with the men, and certainly Josephine Culbertson was able to do that back in the 1920s and 30s.
You are listening to the Commonwealth Club of California radio program, and our speaker today is Gary Pomerantz, journalist visiting lecturer at Stanford University, whose new book is Illuminating the Game of Bridge, The Devil's Tickets, which deals with competitive tensions that games like bridge can create in marital relationships. What about playing bridge for money?
A lot of people do it. A lot of people do it. And, I mean, look, gambling is a part of the American character. Americans love to gamble. I mean, look at the sports sections in today's paper, and you'll see, betting lines on football games, baseball, and basketball games. It's just, they love to do it. At tournament level, in duplicate play, there are some professional bridge players who are available for hire, and they get good money. They get a lot of money to play with people who can afford them. So, most social games don't, play for money, but there are many games that there's big stakes.
Well, you'll forgive me for getting psychological here. I can't help it. It's an occupational hazard. How likely are people to get addicted to gambling through bridge? I mean, many other forms of gambling, horse races and all that, we see a lot of gambling addiction. Is bridge likely to become an addiction?
What I can tell you is bridge is definitely an addictive game. I guess it would depend on the personality. If there are leanings towards gambling that are native to that person, I don't know.
Okay. And if people want to play for money, how does that change the game?
Well, there are some people who are in any game to win, whether there's money or not. And I suspect Myrtle Bennett would have been that way. Myrtle Bennett took her bridge seriously and always played bridge to the very end. And by the way, this much I can tell you, Myrtle Bennett lived another 63 years after that trial. She died 63 years after that fateful night in 1929. 1992, she died. So, bridge is that kind of a game. It draws you in. It's completely absorbing. Can it lead to gambling? It's difficult to know.
Myrtle Bennett lived another 63 years.
63
and did she
years.
Go on playing bridge? I have to know.
Of course. Of course, and there were all kinds of apocryphal stories about her that, that...
Who would be her partner after that?
Right, one of her partners is said to have said to her, "Oh, Myrtle, I'm so sorry. You're going to shoot me for this." Alexander Wolcott wrote that in The New Yorker in, I think, 1933. So,
Poor Myrtle, the butt of all the... Oh, did I say butt of jokes? Do. Guns do have butts. All right. So, Gary, any closing remarks, stories that you want to give us about Bridge, the Bennetts, history, what's going to happen in journalism?
Well, just to say that I would speak more about history itself. You know, to me, there's nothing more discouraging than to see young people coming out of high school thinking history's boring. It's a bunch of dates and numbers. And the truth is, history's the opposite of that. To me, history is thrilling, and it should be exalted. But it's not the kids' fault if they come out of there. There needs to be more imagination, you know, more of the adrenal rush brought to history. And as I say, I revere history, and it speaks to me, and I hope it speaks to all of you.
And is Bridge going to go down in history as a game that more people should have played?
Well, I think so, and I do think, you know, there are signs that Bridge, the popularity of the game is growing.
Good. As a former bid whist player, do I have a shot if I try to learn Bridge?
Absolutely. Okay. You're there.
Glad to hear it.
Rush to the table.
Rush to the table. I'll be right there. Anybody going to join me? Oh, look, you've inspired all these future Bridge players. Are you guys already Bridge players?
Yes.
Ah, there you have it. You have your fans here, Gary. Good. So, last question, who wants to take it? We have time for one more question. We'll take it right from the floor. Yes, sir.
Who are you rooting for in the big game?
Oh, who are you rooting for in the big game?
We're going to have to turn the microphone off for me to answer it. So Cal plays at Stanford this Saturday. I went to Cal. I was a student there. And now I teach at Stanford. And so I am going to the game. And I've decided I'm going to wear, like, brown or something, something very neutral.
It's for the best. And we do have one final question from our audience. Do you have a favorite Bridge website to play online?
Well, there's BridgeBase. .com, and that's where you can go to and watch a lot of games that are being played there online. They have 170,000 people, I think, who play daily all around the world. I believe Warren Buffett plays occasionally there. And it's a good way to get a feel for the game. And there's comments there, people watching the plays and deciding whether someone just made a brilliant move or just made a really bad move. So I would encourage you to take a look there because there's some good Bridge being played there.
Excellent. And I'd like to leave you with a parting shot. I can't help taking it. Enjoy. I know, bad. Enjoy your Bridge. Enjoy your marriage. And remember that what makes Bridge fun is the same thing that makes marriage fun, and that is to appreciate your partner. And... thank you. I'd like to thank Gary Pomerantz.
Thank you.
Journalist, visiting lecturer in the Department of Communication at Stanford University, author of the new book, The Devil's Tickets, A Night of Bridge, A Fatal Hand, and A New American Age. We also want to thank our audiences here. Thank you for being here, everyone, and on radio, television, and the Internet. Today's program has been part of the Commonwealth Club's Good Lit series, underwritten by the Bernard Osher Foundation. I'm Dr. Brenda Wade, and now, this meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, the place where you're in the know, is adjourned.